Good afternoon, good morning, aloha and half a day, everybody. Welcome to the Advocacy Learning Center's bi-monthly affinity discussion. My name is Kata Isari, and I'm going to be the moderator for today's call. I'm so thrilled to welcome teams from three different classes today, Class E, Class F, and Class G. We're delighted to have you all with us today. We're going to be continuing our bi-monthly affinity discussion that explores issues that arise from our work, particularly some of the unique challenges that different affinity groups might experience when they address physical and sexual violence and as we work to be responsive to them in our social change advocacy. As you may remember, last month during our affinity discussion, we talked about strengthening advocacy for the deaf community. And today, we'll be talking about how to strengthen our advocacy for survivors with disabilities. As everybody knows from the immersion events and other Advocacy Learning Center activities, it's very central to our work to understand all aspects of a woman's life, not just their experience of violence. We really emphasize the importance of providing meaningful opportunities for all women to participate as a powerful force for change. So today is an opportunity for us to reflect about how we can strengthen our advocacy in working with survivors with disabilities and identifying organizational challenges and strengths that help us best connect and meet the needs of women with disabilities. As we reference in the publicity and within the framework of the Advocacy Learning Center, it's important to recognize the additional layers of oppression experienced by different marginalized groups, as well as the many challenges they may experience when seeking help. So in order to do this, we're going to fully engage in this discussion today and explore ways to build solidarity with women with disabilities and to increase our connection with women with disabilities and as advocates, improve our ability to create lasting social change. I'm so delighted that we're going to have everybody participating on the call today. As you all may remember, the affinity discussion calls provide a format where you can have an interactive dialogue among your peers. We have a whole group of people that are participating in the fishbowl today, but most of all, we want to hear from everybody on the call today. We really want to encourage you to share your ideas, your challenges, your thoughts, your successes, so we can think together and explore together what the issues are. Remember, the way to do that is to press star 1 and join the conversation by letting the operator know you have a comment. You will hear the call the whole time, and then we'll pull you in as soon as we hear from the operator that you're there. I'd also like to welcome the staff from Manavi and Praxis that are on the call today, Priya and Malini from Manavi, and Sandy, Diane, and Beth from Praxis. Hi, everybody. Good to have you here with us.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the call.
We also have a lot of folks in the fishbowl that are going to be sharing their experiences and ideas with us from two of the programs that went through Advocacy Learning Center. We have Cece Norwood and Imelda Hunt from Nirvana Now. And then we also have Donna Bivona, Kate Johnson, and Donna Kenny from Living in Freedom and Empowerment, or LIFE. Welcome to all of you. Let's start by Cece asking maybe if you could tell us a little bit about Nirvana Now and what is it, the work that you all do?
I can look at it. I'm too busy.
Excuse me, Shane. We can hear you.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Sorry about that. It's some of the challenges of technology. Thank you, Beth, for helping us with that. So, Cece, do you want to tell us a little bit about Nirvana Now and what work you folks do? Okay, Cece, if you're talking, we can't hear you. All right. I think, Imelda, you're on the same line with Cece. Is that right? Because, again, if you're talking, we can't hear you.
Star 6 would open your line back up if you've been muted, Imelda and Cece.
So, Cece and Imelda, you want to try to push star 6?
They just dropped off. I believe they're dialing back in.
Okay. Thank you, Shane. Everybody, that's Shane, our operator, who we're very thankful you're here too. So let's go on, and I'll ask Kate Johnson if you could please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about life and the work that you folks do.
Sure. We are located in South Florida, and we provide help, hope, and healing through education, intervention, and collaboration. We do counseling, we do training, we do email support for around the world, provide literature and resources, and deal basically with all lifespan abuse, so child abuse, teen dating violence, domestic violence, as well as elder abuse.
Great, Kate. Thank you so much. And given our topic today, what is at least one challenge that you've had at life in connecting or engaging with survivors with disabilities that you'd like us to address today?
Well, one of the things that I was talking with Donna B and Donna K about, do we do a good enough job assessing for the disabilities that we, especially the ones we cannot see? Because I would imagine that abusers would use someone's learning disability or reading level against them. And I'm not sure we look at that well enough to determine all aspects of it. So I think that's one of our challenges. How do we best do that?
Very good question, and I think you raised two important points. Not only how do we take the time to fully understand the disabilities that a woman may face and how to respond to that, but also the ways in which that gets used against her by abusers. So thank you for that. We'll make sure that we come to back to that at some point during the conversation. I'm sure lots of people will have ideas about that. Let's and then Donna B and Donna K, do you folks have anything you want to add either about your work or about the challenges that you face?
This is Donna Kay. Not really. I mean, I just had talked to Kate about, you know, what is the scope of a disability. And I think what Kate addressed is not one that we can always see. You know, I mean, how could a batterer, for example, use dyslexia or something like that against a woman? So yeah, our conversation was basically how do we assess better for that?
Thank you, Donna Kay. And Donna B, anything you want to add?
That was mine and Kate's discussion, too, was about, you know, our assessment. But I'm also thinking about our false assumptions. I had a child that had cerebral palsy, and a lot of people confused that with a mental illness, and it was just a physical illness or a physical disability. So sometimes assessing our own assumptions of the person's needs should be a part of that, too.
Yep. Thank you, Donna. That certainly came up also last time as we talked, just that we need to be conscious of what our, as advocates, what we bring to the interactions that may limit us and limit our conversations because of our biases or false assumptions. So thank you. Let's see if Cece and Imelda, are you folks back?
Cece and Imelda? I think so.
Oh, yay. We're so happy. I know you've had some challenges with technology. Cece, do you want to maybe tell us about what Nirvana Now does? Are
you
happy with us?
Yes, yes. Nirvana Now is primarily an organization that works with sexual assault survivors, and our overall goal is to work toward ending, you know, all forms of sexual violence. And, you know, we work with women and teens who, with the permission of their, you know, caregiver, is allowed to participate, you know, with our services. So we do support groups, where we call them speak outs, actually, and we provide individual life coaching services, and we do educational trainings for anyone interested who wants to learn about sexual assault.
Okay, thank you, Cece. And is there one challenge that you could name that you found in trying to connect with survivors with disabilities that you'd like us to address today?
I think, you know, probably a primary challenge is understanding as best we can the culture in which they live. I think I'll just leave it at that, understanding their culture so that we'll know best how to work with them.
Okay, so is it similar to... Go ahead.
Well, I guess I'm thinking primarily, you know, working with deaf women who are also women of color. who sort of have a, you know, maybe a double whammy, you know, so to speak, in that they're dealing with, you know, cultural and racial issues related to them being a woman of color, and then on top of that, you know, dealing with their disability as well.
So it sounds like it's trying to, going back to that piece about understanding the full context of the woman's life and mm-hmm. the different issues that are relevant just in moving through life and then are impacted by the physical and sexual violence that they may experience.
You got it.
Okay, that's great, Cece. Thank you so much. I'm sure that will come up today. Imelda, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
Hi. I just wanted to add that along with that piece also is that people with disability that I work with, they also should have a voice in their care and their caregiving. I work with people who are primary caregivers, and they sometimes do not understand that it is person-centered care by law, that they have a voice in their own caregiving. And those are some of the challenges that face.
That's great. Thank you, Imelda. And I think, you know, in terms of kind of our general approach in the Advocacy Learning Center, that really specifies the importance that we place on women and survivors being part of our work and not separate from what we do and how we do social change. So I really appreciate that. I want to, we're going to move the conversation a little bit into looking at now that you've all identified some of the challenges, what is it that you are doing that you think has been helpful in consciously and deliberately engaging and connecting with survivors with disabilities? Kate, do you have some ideas about what you have done that's been effective in your program around connecting with survivors with disabilities?
Well, one of the things that I think that we do is when we do community training, and we do a lot of trainings within not only the religious community but the secular community, but when we talk about this domestic violence especially, is having pieces in there that talk about special needs of people with disabilities. So that kind of opens the door, I think, for them to know we care about the issue, but also that we want them to care about the issue. We want them to be more cognizant of it in whatever they're doing. So I'm not sure if that's what you mean, but I think that's one of the areas that we try and engage the community as well as the survivors.
Okay, so let me just see if I understand that, Kate. So when, what you're saying is that when you do general public education around sexual and domestic violence or the range of issues that you work on, that you're sure to incorporate some of the unique challenges for survivors with disabilities as a way to broaden connection with survivors with disabilities and the community at large? Is that
right, right. And also, I teach at a university, so I also include that piece in my classes when I'm teaching about domestic violence, when I'm teaching about counseling and advocating with people. So I kind of try and broaden it out. Also, I think one of the things is making sure our office and our workspace is accessible for someone in a wheelchair, for instance, or someone who maybe can't walk a long distance. And that's been an interesting thing because, for instance, we've had free office space offered to us, but it was not ADA compliant. It would not have been an easy access for someone with a disability. And the people who were offering us the office space could not see why that was an issue for us. So we didn't get the free space, but, you know, that's okay.
So those are really important points in terms of you're both connecting with survivors with disabilities and the broader community with that in mind. How has it gone for you in your education work or in your community work as you've tried to bring forward these issues?
I think there's a lot that people do not take into account. I mean,
doesn't even cross their minds. So that's always interesting for me. So, for instance, if you have a person that you're working with who is visually impaired, to be make sure that you're facing them when you talk to them. And people can't figure that out because, well, they can't see anyways, what's the big deal? Except our voice travels in a certain direction, and so we have to be aware of that, how we're perceived. And it's interesting because it's not what people normally think about.
That's a really, and that is something that you talk about. I know that your organization is mostly volunteer-run and staffed, is that correct?
Yes.
And so is that something that you, how do you help people learn that who are going to be working with survivors of disabilities?
Well, because for our volunteers, they have to go through our core training. And in our core training, which is modeled after the Florida Coalition Certified Domestic Violence trainings that are required. We modeled it after that. I used to be a core comp trainer. And so we incorporate that, and people are very open to it once they understand that there is an issue to be aware of.
Well, those are very specific and concrete suggestions in terms of what has been working, because we want to really consider the whole range of challenges and successes. Let's hear a little bit from Nirvana now. Cece or Imelda, can you share something in terms of how you structure your program or your policies and practices that has been effective in engaging with women or survivors who have disabilities?
Well, you know, one of the things I think that's nice about, you know, our organization is that we're not really mired down, I think, in a lot of hard, fast policies and procedures, you know, and that we're not connected to, you know, major institutions. And, you know, as a result of that, that allows for greater flexibility in what it is that we do. And I've worked for other organizations that are, and there is some challenges, you know, related to that. And so not having those type of connections makes it a lot easier for us, I think, to meet the woman wherever she is. And so it is not unheard of for us to meet a woman at her home or, you know, meet a woman at another site if our primary site is not, you know, one that is accessible, you know, to her. We have access to, other resources that can assist us, you know, no matter what, I guess, that woman's particular disability is, or it's, I don't know, it's more of a kind of a wraparound thing. I mean, it's a collaborative thing. It's allowed us to be more into coalition building than being, I guess, a standalone, you know, type of organization. And so as a result of that, we don't usually have to deal with or be bothered with some of the issues that perhaps other organizations do.
So that's really interesting. I think that's probably novel for, as you said, a lot of the organizations on the call may have a different challenge of having policies and procedures that guide their work. But in terms of this issue that you don't have as much that restricts you, what have you found in particular with survivors' disabilities? Has it been being able to go out into the community? Is that flexibility the thing that's been the key in connecting with survivors' disabilities?
I think most definitely. In fact, you know, probably in the last 3 or 4 months, you know, we've developed a tighter relationship with a mental health organization here. And that has allowed us, you know, access to those survivors there that they may have presented, you know, with other issues, but once it comes out through their services that there is, you know, a sexual abuse history or sexual violence, you know, like Imelda mentioned about working with caregivers, sometimes the caregivers aren't the best folks, you know, to be, you know, to have primary care over these people. It's allowed us then to go into this mental health facility and utilize the staff that they have there, the expertise in some areas that, that we don't have, that we, if we were strictly standalone, Nirvana Now only, would maybe struggle, you know, with some of that.
Yeah, that importance of building our connections and partnerships in the community really can't be underemphasized, right? And I think that's a very powerful example of that. And speaking of that, I'm going to pull in another guest that we have in the fishbowl right now. Thank you, Cece and Kate, for sharing those ideas with that. We'll be developing more ideas as we go on. But we're really excited to welcome Nancy Smith. A lot of you know Nancy because she is a faculty for the Advocacy Learning Center, so she may have been present during her first event. But you may not know that she's actually been working to end violence against people with disabilities since 2001. And she works for the Vera Institute of Justice and is a national TA provider. Nancy brings a wealth of experience and knowledge, and we're so happy to welcome her to join this conversation. She has a lot of good information to share, but is a wonderful person to answer questions and help us think through how we can best connect with and work with women or survivors of disabilities. Welcome, Nancy. It's so good to have you here.
Thanks, Katya. I'm happy to be here.
And I just, as I kind of start to explore some of the discussion with Nancy, I just want to remind everybody that's on the call that we would really want to hear from you and talk with all of the people in the fishbowl and with each other. And the way you can do that is to press star one and then share with us your comments or your questions, your ideas. And while people are thinking about what they want to say in this conversation and either pressing star one or emailing advocacy@praxisinternational.org. Let's ask Nancy if you could kind of join in to what we've been exploring together so far. And what do you think would be some of the unique challenges that come up for programs and working with survivors of disabilities?
I think a couple things come to mind. The first, just in listening to the conversation so far, that's been on my mind is just the how big and diverse the group of women with disabilities is. You know, if you look at disability, that's, you know, women with disabilities in particular, it's over 30 million women. And as we've already talked about, it really includes a lot of different things from visible disabilities to invisible disabilities. It includes everything from physical disabilities to mental health or psychiatric disabilities and learning disabilities, as we've talked about. So there really is an incredible amount of diversity, and I think that that can be challenging for a few reasons. One is that I think one of the strengths, which we can talk about in a little bit, is that the disability communities have been fairly organized. But because there's such diversity, there's a lot of different groups and there's a lot of places to actually go to start connecting with women. And again, that can be a strength, but I think that can also be somewhat challenging. I think it can also be challenging just because we're not sure, given kind of the diversity of disability, you know, what it means in terms of what people's needs are and how to best meet their needs. But I think as we've sort of talked about, the best thing really is to talk to women, to connect with them, because we know that a diagnosis does very little to predict what someone's needs might be. But the last reason this kind of came to mind for me, you know, I think when we think about disability generally and what it is and what it isn't, you know, there's a lot of different things that sort of define that. There's kind of legal definitions around disability that are fairly broad, and then there's sort of personal identification. And so, you know, one example of that would be deaf women. From a legal perspective, they are included in the Americans with Disabilities Act and fall under the definition of disability. But, you know, from some of the work we've already been doing in the ALC, from sort of a personal identification, a cultural group identification, they don't identify as having disability and more so identify as a cultural and linguistic group. So it just points to me more this sort of importance of connecting with women and really following their lead, not only in terms of what they need, but also in terms of honoring their unique identity. So that's sort of one challenge that comes to mind for me. A couple other, certainly the... Oh, go ahead.
Jump in, Nancy. I'm sorry.
Sure.
That's
sorry.
Really helpful because I was kind of wondering that as we were moving through this discussion and thinking about having this discussion is just the broadness of the category of women with disabilities. And that's been really helpful for you to remind us that there are both personal and legal definitions. And what would you suggest, given that what you just stated, that we would keep in our mind as advocates when we talk with different women to explore what are some of the challenges they may face, which kind of alludes to that question of how do we know the way to best respond to women?
I mean, for me, it's really about building relationships with women and really, you know, spending time to get to know women and to be very open to everyone who's in front of us and to connect with them and learn a little bit more about what's important to them and how they see themselves in the world and what their needs are and a little bit about sort of their journey and how they see themselves. And I think that can be very helpful in figuring out how to create a place that that meets their needs, that is inclusive of who they are. So for me, it's really about that relationship building piece.
That's really helpful. Thank you for that. And I know you're about to go on. You've talked a little bit about some of the challenges that programs may face. Are there challenges that you think survivors with disabilities face in coming to our programs that we should keep in mind?
Yeah, I think... you know, certainly a couple things come to mind there. You know, I think that there is, you know, in our society, I think that there's a lot of stereotypes, for example, of people with disabilities being asexual, of people with disabilities not being worthy of relationships. And I think because of that, people with disabilities have sex education has been withheld from them. Information on healthy relationships have been withheld from them. So I think, you know, that creates a number of challenges. One, folks may not identify what they're experiencing as abuse, which is a pretty big barrier. I think that related to that, you may have parents, for example, who have some of those beliefs themselves about either their children with disabilities or their adult children with disabilities. And so they may, you know, one of the things that we talk about a lot is that sometimes parents, and this is also true of disability providers, in an attempt to protect people with disabilities from abuse may actually be creating more of sort of a prison of protection rather than a ring of safety around them. So they may, you know, even more want to withhold information about sex education or maybe are very reticent to even start talking to people about abuse because of those sort of stereotypes. So I think that kind of paternalism, which I think some of the other folks have touched on, can certainly create barriers for the individual to reach out as well. And I think also, you know, people have had experiences where, you know, something might not have been accessible. And I think, you know, that to someone who has a disability who, you know, has to move around in an inaccessible world is, you know, can lead to folks being excluded, and I think that's very painful for people. So I think there could be some mistrust to, for lack of better terms, kind of mainstream services and systems, i.e. those that aren't disability specific, and a real reticence to reach out there for help, because is it going to be a place where they can get their needs met, where they feel like people are comfortable with them, where they're going to be understood, or where they're going to be believed? Because I think that's the other thing in our society. We don't think people with disabilities are credible. And so you have a lot of folks who have a whole lifetime of not being believed for a whole host of things, and I think that they have real concerns about whether they'll be believed when they would reach out and disclose that they've been a victim of sexual assault or domestic violence.
Wow, that's a lot of rich information. Thank you, Nancy. I think it really helps to summarize what the challenges might be for survivors with disabilities coming to our programs, and so helpful for us to keep in mind as we think about the advocacy issues. I really want to encourage either people in the fishbowl or people listening to let us know your thoughts and your questions and your comments. Maybe we can go to...
Kata, this is Cece.
Go ahead.
And I guess I have, you know, one thing to kind of throw in here. You know, Nancy was talking in particular, I think others have too, about how, you know, part of what we're doing is that we have to see the woman from her perspective and you know, understand that how she sees the world and, you know, things of that nature. And I have to say that in my travels, when I've been around women who have what we would call disabilities, they take issue, you know, with that term, just like Nancy mentioned, you know, the deaf community does. What I have learned is that they prefer to be referred to as women with different abilities. And so I guess I kind of like to, you know, to throw that out there to see what people think, because, you know, language, you know, is important. And I think disabilities versus, you know, of different abilities has perhaps different connotations to it, which might in turn direct how services of any kind, you know, are provided to the individual.
That's an excellent point, Cece, and I appreciate you raising that because, as everybody knows, we're so attentive to language and the meaning of language at the ALC. Nancy, do you have thoughts about that, or anyone else in the fishbowl that wants to jump in?
Well, this is Nancy. I would just sort of echo that. I think that language is incredibly important, and I think it's, you know, one of the things that has been so valuable for me to do in my work is to sit down with people who have disabilities and to talk to them about their language preferences, and it certainly helped us inform the language that we use and to be more welcoming through the language we use to people. And you know, I think that from talking to people with disabilities and talking to other advocates out there, I would certainly say that I think there's a complicated relationship that people have with the term disability and even with identifying as someone who has a disability or even someone who has different abilities. I think that that really varies, and I think that's one of the places where we've seen a lot in talking to survivors that, you know, people from communities of color, for example, may identify with the term disability very differently than a white kind of middle class person may identify with it. And they also, I think, this is a little bit of a tangent, may identify with the disability community differently as a result. And I think that's really important to think about when we are working to connect with women with disabilities. I think there's a lot of great resources in the community. And I think, for example, independent living centers are a great place to reach out to women. But this isn't true of all independent living centers, but they tend to be to reach out more to white communities of people with disabilities, and part of that has to do with the history that they were created by white middle to upper class men who had polio, and so their services were really designed with that in mind. And there's really been a long movement within the independent living center movement, for example, to change that, but there's a lot of work to be done. And I think being cognizant of that and not just doing kind of outreach efforts to independent living centers, but really broadening that to health centers. And I think you see more, you know, you start to broaden out women with disabilities that you'll connect with when you start looking at all those different places to start reaching out to them.
That's a really, thank you, Nancy, for sharing that bit of history. It's very helpful to understand the context. Even within the work of Ounce Against Women, there's so much history and context that can get a little overwhelming. So to be able to be exposed to the context for collaborating with other community organizations is so useful. I want to take a minute and develop that idea, there's two things that you said that were so important in terms of both you and CC were talking about language and then how that may be different by different communities, whether it's communities of color. I was thinking about immigrant communities as you were speaking. And I know that sometimes, just to be honest, it's challenging for me in my work because I feel like I can't keep up with what is a term that has meaning and is respectful, and because language is so evolutionary. I'm just thinking about how we refer to women and survivors and victims and clients. We've had that conversation at the ALC. Are there suggestions that anybody who's on the fishbowl would have around how to help manage that evolutionary nature as we go through our learning process? Or anybody listening, you're welcome to push star one or email a comment to advocacy@practiceinternational.org. But Nancy or anyone else on the fishbowl want to pipe in about this language and how we can stay up to date with language that is respectful and meaningful?
This is Sandy.
Hi, Sandy. Go ahead.
You know, I just had a thought, and I just can't stop myself. I wanted to throw it out there. As I'm listening to this conversation, I was thinking, you know, but it's, you're right, language is so critical. And then there's this self-defining, and I don't know how to say this without just kind of using an example. You know, as a Native American woman, people struggle with that all the time. Well, do I say Indian? Do I say American Indian? Do I say Native American? Do I say Ojibwe or do I say Anishinaabe? So, you know, if they even think of that. But when I think about the skills that we talk about so much in the Advocacy Learning Center, that skill of connecting with a person and really understanding all aspects of her life would, you know, as we hone those skills, we would get to a place where we would hear that individual's self-defining language. Does that make sense?
That makes great sense. It sounds like you're expanding on Nancy's point of really building relationship.
Yeah.
Not to be formulaic, but also what we say in the Advocacy Learning Center and that social change advocacy chart about engaging and dialoguing versus counseling or advising, thinking about ways to really join with women, which I think even for folks who have a counseling background is very much integral to our philosophy and our approach in the helping professions, is that we connect in terms of what's meaningful for the person that we're supporting or helping.
Right.
Are there other people in the fishbowl who have thoughts about that?
This is Donna B. I was reading of one article, and a person wrote in there that she likes to be described as a person with a disability because she puts the person first. And she said, I want to be a person first, not acknowledged as my disability. So I think it's exactly what you're saying, Sandy. You listen to what the survivor says, and you go along with however they want to be defined.
Mm-hmm.
Very helpful.
Thank you, Donna.
Again, if people have thoughts about this or other issues, just press star one or send an email to advocacy@practiceinternational.org. Someone was just about to say something when I said that. Was there another comment?
This is Nancy. I just wanted to add, too, that, you know, I think it's really important for all the reasons that we just said for us to be very intentional about our language and for us to, you know, follow the person's lead and also to, you know, build connections in the disability community. I think that helps to stay informed about language as it evolves. But I've also seen that sometimes we can get really afraid to talk or afraid to really move into this area and do work because we're afraid that we're going to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. And I just want to caution against that. I think that, you know, obviously we want to be real intentional, and I think we want to create an environment in a whole host of ways that builds trust and that, that meets people where they are and helps meet their needs. Language is one way to do that. I think there's a lot of other ways to do that. And I think if you have a lot of those other things in place and you do make a mistake in your language, that folks are really forgiving. And I think part of that is really creating an environment where we can have conversations with survivors and where someone could say, hey, you know, actually you just said this and, you know, I prefer this term instead and here's sort of why. So I just wanted to also bring that up because I have seen it really shut down work in this area, that fear.
Well, that's a very useful point to a question that we just got. So let me read the question and then see what thoughts the folks in the fishbowl have about this. The writer says, I have experience with one survivor who is hearing impaired, and I've had difficulties in communicating with her as well as her translator. I suspect that she's trying to hide what is really happening to her. What's the proper way of convincing her to tell the real story? Any thoughts about that or suggestions for the person who sent that question in? Nancy, do you want to start us off?
Wow. Well, I mean, my first thoughts are really that it's very similar to working with and sitting with any survivor, you know, that it's a process of building a relationship and building trust for people to be able to open up and share their full experiences with you. I don't think it would be different necessarily for a survivor with a disability or a deaf survivor. Unless somehow in that particular environment, I mean, something that's different with deaf survivors in this case is that there is an interpreter. And so I would always want to figure out if there is some relationship that that interpreter could have to the perpetrator, or because it is such a small community, is the reticence at all linked to who that interpreter is? Obviously, it's very hard to figure that out when you rely on that interpreter for communication, and so that's one of the reasons it's really helpful to have people who can use basic sign language. But if you don't have that, you can always try to connect individually with that woman depending on their communication skills. While I don't at all think it's a great idea to write back and forth in moments of crisis, but I do think in an instance when I've had problems with interpreters, I've been able to say, can we just have a moment alone and try to communicate, whether it be through writing or through some other means, to try to figure out if there is a problem with the interpreter. Again, I don't know if that's the case in this instance, but it's something to consider.
That's a very important consideration, especially given the smallness of the community that you talked about. Thank you, Nancy. And I go ahead, Cece, was that? Or
you know, I was just going to ask, you know, this is Cece, add one other thing. You know, I would just wonder, and Imelda and I were sort of rolling this around. I don't know why she won't talk, but, you know, we're also wondering, is there, we think about the complexity of women, is there something else? I mean, is there a racial difference? You know, is there a cultural difference? Is there a socioeconomic difference, you know, that also may be in play other than, you know, in addition to the language barrier?
That's great. I think sometimes it's natural, and I've done this as an advocate, that we assume that the most visible difference between us and the survivor is what is the barrier, but there may be something else that isn't about that particular difference, or it may be about that. But having, just again, going back to this theme that we seem to be developing of finding ways to really explore from the women's perspective and being able to do that through a combination of mechanisms is really important. Anyone else that's in the fishbowl want to jump in on this question? Beth, Diane, Sandy, Priya, Malini, either the Donnas or Kate?
This is Kate. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead, Kate.
Okay, so I had to call back in. I think the whole concept of creating that relationship where they feel comfortable correcting you or letting you know what they want is very, very important. And I've found when I work with women who, for lack of a better term, are different than me, which is every single woman, I make it a point to say, you know, there are some things that I'm probably not going to understand about you, and this I would like to learn as much from you as you learn from me. So I want you to know that I want to learn how to best help you, how to best relate to you. I had a client who was Native American. She was Dene, and we were talking, and in the beginning, she said to me that she was Apache. And so at one point, I said that to her, and she said, you know, I really dislike that. And I said, okay, I'm sorry, can you explain to me why? And she explained that was the word the white man gave to the tribe, but the tribe itself considered itself Dene. I said, well, you know, I'm so glad that you corrected me and that you were able to help me to learn, because that's really important. And it changed. It actually changed her ability to trust me and to be more open. And so I think part of the relationship building and getting people who maybe are hearing impaired and can't relate without an interpreter, it's being that person that believes what they say, even if it's not the whole truth, so that at some point they will give you the whole truth.
Thank you. That's a good reminder, and it really speaks to the, again, the relationship building, but demonstrating our trustworthiness and finding ways to build that relationship and let people know our willingness. And thank you very much for the question that was emailed in. That was obviously led to some very helpful insights and conversation with the fishbowl. I understand from the operator that we actually have someone in the queue with a question.
Yes, we have Alice with D's Unity. Go ahead.
Yes. Hi. We have to go back a little bit. I just want to talk a little bit about working with deaf clients, and I want to make one correction as well. We don't use the word hearing impaired. That's really an unacceptable term for the deaf community. We would prefer to be called deaf or hard of hearing. And so that aside, the second thing I'd like to talk about is with the interpreter, and it's kind of a love-hate relationship between the interpreter and the deaf community. When you bring the interpreter in, maybe they know that person, or, you know, I mean, there's just a natural code of professionalism, and the interpreter has to be neutral. And, you know, there are two views on that, one of them being the interpreter. Maybe for some deaf clients, it's better that the interpreter be neutral. And that's all, because, you know, and really there's a fear that if the interpreter is not neutral, then the community would know about it. And so there's a fear of the victim point of their point of view. And so, and also there are many things to think about in regards to an interpreter. The interpreter may be a friend of the abuser, or the interpreter might have, you know, a high status in that community, in the deaf community. So, you know, you can't, I mean, to think about an interpreter bringing them in to solve the problem, I mean, maybe you bring in the interpreter that, you know, the victim was traumatized by past experiences with that person. And also, some interpreters are really, you know, helpful to the deaf community, like they just want to help, you know, and there is a codependency relationship there in some situations, and so really you have to be careful, and, you know, there's that. So that aside, my suggestion is, well, it's important that we have interpreter training in domestic violence, in assault, traumatic experiences, controlling, you know, understanding all of those really in depth. And then also programs working with interpreting agencies, you need to see and come up with the best qualified interpreters for the situation, like domestic violence and sexual assault in court and things of that nature. Also, clients may have a preference for interpreters, and so the one you hire may not, or they may oppress the client's wishes. So it's important to have a dialogue and discussion about that. And the best, what's the best interpreter for that situation? I mean, I'm just throwing all these out because, you know, it's not just easy to bring in an interpreter and think that they're going to help the situation. And so, you know, I really encourage co-advocacy with the interpreting agency, especially an agency who provides direct services in American Sign Language. And you have to bring them in to assess the client's communication needs and, you know, other needs as well. So I guess that's, it's really important for you guys to try and match domestic violence and sexual assault and deaf services, but also find a deaf agency who can, you know, provide that assistance.
Alice, those are a lot of really helpful and important points that you made. I wonder if we could go back to one of the early points in your comments, which you said the importance of having an interpreter that was neutral. And you certainly gave us some ideas for how, as programs and advocates, we can develop relationships in the community with the deaf community and with the service providers. But are there any specific suggestions you would have for helping advocates assess that the interpreter is someone that's neutral? Does that go to your final point about really finding out the preference from the client, or are there other ways in which we could try to
Yes. I mean, I think it's important to get in touch and just see what are the resources in your hometown or in your state in regards to communication. I'm thinking something like an Office for the Deaf of Hard of Hearing, a Commission for the Deaf of Hard of Hearing, or the ILC with Deaf Program Services, you know, and just have them come to your agency and provide a training, provide, you know, technical assistance, figuring out what the best way to screen or how the best way to assess a client's communication needs.
That's very helpful, and that makes me think that it's so important to be doing that now, not just when a deaf survivor walks in your door or contacts you for the first time, so that you're building those relationships over time. Are there other questions or comments for Alice and what she raised? Anybody in the fishbowl? We have another comment that I want to read in just a moment, but I want to make sure that people in the fishbowl have a chance to respond to what Alice said. Any thoughts? Okay. Well, it was a very, very helpful and specific information. Thank you, Alice, for that. I'm now going to read a comment that was emailed to us by Vanessa, and it says, I think the discussion around the importance of working on the relationship with the survivor and understanding what the survivor's understanding and experience of her own disabilities slash abilities slash needs and goals are is the foundation for important and significant work. In addition, I believe it's key for the helper slash counselor, etc., to display true patience and faith in the client in their work together so that if things need to be asked, stated, explained over and over, if distractions and challenges need to be addressed over and over, there is a sense created that these are not challenges, but simply circumstances of their work together. I think that, and that is emphasized, I think that is how you remove the stigmas that can be barriers to working with these individuals and to these individuals working with non-disabled helpers. For example, as someone who struggles with anxiety, I appreciate that my coworkers don't tiptoe around me, and yet they think about how they approach me in the process of challenging me addressing me, giving me responsibilities that will trigger me. They honor the fact that I've stated I'm actively pushing past my boundaries, which will trigger my anxiety. And so when that happens during our meetings and I start reacting anxiously and maybe break down a little, they can tolerate it with me and they can also move on from it with me as I learn to manage it without leaving the situation. I feel less and less like I interrupted the meeting somehow and more like it's just something that happens that we work with as we complete our goals of the moment. So thank you, Vanessa, for that comment. Do people in the fishbowl want to pick up on, again, the theme of the importance of working on the relationship and understanding that it's something that develops over time? Donna, Kate, CC, Imelda, Priya, Malini, Beth?
This is Sandy.
Sandy, go ahead.
Well, I just love having this conversation because when we talk about the complexities of of every woman that accesses our programs and that she's so much more than the violence she's experiencing, and all this discussion and the things that people are saying and thinking about and responding to just really emphasizes how sometimes, our programs are organized in ways that we just are not given enough time to really build that relationship. Nancy, I think you said it a couple times, it's so important to build that relationship, but if we don't have the time to really talk and explore and get to know and understand her and she gets to understand you and, all those things that we talk about, it's just so critical, and I just want to say thanks. I'm glad we're talking about this.
It is really exciting. Thank you, Sandy, and we're actually getting a lot of comments coming in, so I'm going to read a few more that have been emailed to us, and the one that just came kind of builds perfectly on what you were just saying, also from Vanessa. I really wish that VAWA or other federal funds would address the needs of survivors with disabilities, e.g., creating grants for positions at agencies for the disabled, such as a counselor who is proficient in sign language, a case manager specializing in the needs of people with disabilities, an assistant to orient survivors who are blind, etc. We have another comment in the queue, which I will get to in 1 second, but I want to pick up on that because, Nancy, you mentioned something earlier about having some basic sign language familiarity. Are there other thoughts that you have or other people in the fishbowl have about not just advocating to get more funds from the government and funders to develop more capacity, but things that any of us could do to increase our familiarity or knowledge in a way that would allow us to be more proficient? Nancy, what do you think?
What immediately comes to mind for me is just building partnerships with disability organizations and with deaf organizations that are in the community already, because I think they have a lot of resources to bring to the table. So whether that be knowledge and, sitting down and helping you figure out how to ask the right questions at the right time to people to learn about, whether they have a disability and what their needs are. Or it might be tapping you into assistive technology loaning libraries where if someone had to flee in an emergency and weren't able to bring all of their assistive technology, they may be able to rent or actually get something at no cost from an organization that exists in the community. And I think all of that, happens through relationship building over time. And so for me, it's just that we don't have to do it all ourselves. I think there's a lot of capacity we do need to build, but there are organizations out there who they know how to connect to people with disabilities. They know their needs, and it's about sort of combining our expertise and using it.
Thank you, Nancy. That's helpful. It certainly builds on comments that both Alice and CC made. Is there anyone else in the fishbowl that wants to add on to that point?
This is Cece, and I just, you know, wanted to make comment that, you know, I'm thinking, you know, visualizing, you know, the first immediate contact, you know, with the woman before you have opportunity to, you know, to maybe tap into those coalitions or those partnerships that you have made with people. And, you know, what I've learned is that sometimes, you know, dealing with a survivor, for example, who is deaf, is very simple in terms of just facing them straight on. You know, of course, we know and they know that, you know, lip reading is not 100%. I mean, it depends on, you know, their level of ability in that regard. But, you know, just facing them sometimes, you know, can pick up some words. The other thing I've learned, too, is just paper and pencil. You know, picking up paper and pencil and communicating in that way is the way of, you know, getting it started while you're waiting on the interpreter, while you're waiting on the partners who, you know, help you with that community or any other community, you know, for that matter, you know, to respond. Because it is important, I think, in those, as we all know, you know, in those early moments in the sexual violence environment anyway, when you're first responding, that it is those first impressions, you just, they're the most lasting. We all know that cliche, and it's hard to, you know, to come back from them. So I would just add that as something else, too.
Very important to keep in mind. Thank you, Cece. Any other comments from the fishbowl on this piece before we move on?
The only thing that, this is Kate, the only other thing that I was thinking about as everybody was talking is going back to the reason it's so important to ask them what they need, no matter who it is that we're working with, because they may have a need that we didn't think about, and it goes back to our perceptions of their needs. And they may not be willing to tell us what they need because of the way they've been treated in the past, their history, all of that stuff. Or as Donna B said, how their abuser has used whatever their disability is against them. So being able to ask people and then be where they're at. So, for instance, I had a person, a woman I was working with, who was in a wheelchair, and she was really struggling, and it had nothing to do with the abuse she was suffering. It had to do with how she had been treated at church the previous week because she was in a wheelchair. And so our time together, that became the focus of our time together, and thinking through, okay, ways she could maybe self-advocate in that dynamic, which had nothing to do with what was going on in her abuse, but really did because it tied into an abusive treatment. So, again, being willing to ask the questions and then be where they're at, figuring out how to help them.
That's, again, an important reminder as we kind of become a theme for this conversation, which is so useful. I really appreciate we've gone off on a very interesting line of conversation where we've been developing and explore some of these issues more fully. One thing that I was thinking about, Nancy, is we were talking about some of the challenges that the disabilities community or survivors of disabilities face. I wonder, what do you think are some of the strengths that can facilitate survivors with disabilities coming together that we might want to keep in mind as we explore the advocacy issues for us?
Well, I think one of the things is that, you know, one of the sort of defining mottos, if you will, of disability communities is nothing about us without us. And I think that there is a real history and sort of current living out of that motto where people with disabilities, women with disabilities are very much active and engaged in advocating around issues that are central to their lives and their experiences. And I think there's been a lot of movement over the past 10 years to develop advocacy among people with disabilities and women with disabilities around domestic violence and sexual assault and stalking. And so I think there's a real opportunity to build on that And, you know, when I talk to a lot of people with disabilities, one of the things they say is, we're ready. We just want an invitation to come to the table. And so I think that that passion and commitment is a real strength that we can definitely build on. And I think, you know, what I said before, I think there's a real sense of community among people with disabilities. There's a, you know, shared history and shared struggles and experiences, and that has led to people all over the country organizing in lots of different ways. So it's not as though we have to start from scratch in terms of reaching out to people. There's, you know, all sorts of groups of people with disabilities that meet on a regular basis that I think we can tap into to build connections and to start kind of working together and advocating together. And I think one of the most promising pieces there are self-advocates, which, you know, that term has been coined by the disability community, you know, to really refer to people with disabilities advocating on their behalf. It has particular relevance around people with cognitive disabilities and mental health disabilities as well. And there's a lot of, there's a national organization called Self-Advocates Becoming Empowered. It's all about creating opportunities for people with disabilities to advocate for themselves and others. And they have a real interest around domestic and sexual violence, and there's chapters across the country that I think are great places to start connecting with women with disabilities.
Very helpful, as usual. Thank you, Nancy. That organization that you mentioned, is that something, Beth or Diane, that we could get on the website for people so that we can have that as a resource available for people wanting to learn more?
Absolutely. We'll post it so you can look for it under this call's resources.
Thank you. And as we, you know, think about the final time that we have together, I wanted to build on some of what Nancy just mentioned and go to a comment we had from someone who emailed to think about what are some of the advocacy implications about what we've raised today and how might we structure our work in ways that would allow us as advocates to more fully connect in meaningful ways with survivors of disabilities and to connect them with others working to end violence against women, as well as, of course, with each other and with the broader community. We have a very specific question that was asked, and I'm going to read it, but ask that we think about it in the more general context, given that we want to use the remaining time to talk about some of the broader advocacy implications for us. Somebody writes in, I'm currently working with a client who has cognitive impairment. She works 30 hours a week at a local grocery, owns her own home, and is able to take public transportation. She does have staff that help her live independently by providing transportation and financial management. She has a guardian, which is a local agency that supports individuals with cognitive impairment. This agency has sought a PPO, a protection order against someone she feels is a friend, and insisted that she come to our agency, Shelter House, to receive DV, non-residential support. She sees a counselor and attends the DV support group, all of this against her will. She does not want to come and is seeking for the PPO to be dropped. I would love any advice on how to work with her and this agency. My thoughts are conflicted. So I think there's a lot of problem solving that we might be able to do in this general, in this specific situation. But I wonder, as we think about there's two issues, there may be many more that I'm missing, but two that come up. One is a woman with a disability who is being directed by her guardian, this agency, to do something she doesn't want to do. How to respond to that, and then how does the shelter, which is working with her, work both with her and the other agency in this context? And that may be a good launch for us into thinking about some of the advocacy implications. So why don't we start with Nancy and then see if anyone else in the fishbowl have any thoughts about what we may want to consider in working with situations like this where women are being compelled to do something they don't want to do by their guardian. Nancy, do you have thoughts?
I have a lot of thoughts. One, though, I would just say that you are not alone in in this experience, I hear all the time from people who share with me that, you know, they may be a person with a disability themselves, where their guardian or their parents, who may not be a legal guardian anymore, but nonetheless have forced them into receiving services for sexual assault when they do not believe that they were sexually assaulted, and they believe it was consensual, for example. I think it is very, very complicated. There's a lot of, it's very layered. I would say one is to, I sound like a broken record, but really to talk to the woman about what her experiences is and how she thinks about and perceives the relationship that she has with this individual. Part of it, I think, is to learn more. I mean, I do think, as I mentioned before, that there has been some paternalism among parents and among guardians that stem from feelings that people with disabilities can't be sexual. And there's a whole movement among people with disabilities about the right to sexuality. So it's you know, really about getting information and really understanding, again, what's happening and what her perceptions are. And I think similarly talking to the guardian, the organization, to understand their perceptions. And I think, you know, having dialogue with them, I mean, I think it may, you may educate them. They may also educate you, which is all getting information to help you figure out what your next steps should be. I think without knowing more specific, it's hard to get more specific.
Those are very useful, though, especially keeping it in a broad context that anybody listening can benefit from in terms of using with their work and thinking about how this may be a familiar type of situation. Are there other thoughts from people in the fishbowl, from Nirvana Now or Life or the faculty or staff of Praxis or Not Manavi, about this particular question? Well, what I'd like to take it to then is thinking about, and again, maybe we'll start with Nancy and then we'll broaden it out, about what are the meaningful opportunities that exist for engagement around our connection with women survivors of disabilities as advocates and as programs that can help to strengthen our work. We've raised a lot of ideas today, but as we draw our time together to a close and we think about what might be some thoughts to leave people with around what can we do in an ongoing way that would really allow us as programs and advocates engage in more meaningful engagement. Nancy, do you have some thoughts about that you want to start us off with?
Yeah, I think for me, and it echoes some of the things that I've already said, you know, and I think in thinking about what everyone else on the call has said, I think women's very first interaction with you is so important. I mean, it really sets the tone for, you know, the decisions they make around continuing to engage with your program or not. And I think, you know, really I think it's important for programs in particular when we're thinking about disability just to be as prepared as possible so that in that moment when there's someone with a disability who reaches out, it really is welcoming and it's accessible. And I think to start working in different areas, whether it be your policies or whether it be your physical building, is that even accessible? I think one of the best opportunities for engagement is to reach out to disability organizations. You know, a lot of disability organizations have bylaws that require 50% of their staff to have disabilities. And I think, you know, you can partner with disability organizations, you can begin connecting with staff, and they can really help you become prepared and help you take a look at your policies and help you take a look at your physical building, and see where you can make enhancements to create a more welcoming sort of environment and a more inclusive environment. And I think through those relationships, you'll necessarily start connecting with the folks that they're serving, which will help you kind of broaden your network of women with disabilities that you're connected to.
Very useful. Thank you, Nancy. I wonder, Nirvana now, Cece or Imelda, do you have a final thought or suggestion about ways to build meaningful engagement you'd like to share with the group?
Hi, this is Imelda. I think the key thing for me throughout this whole conversation has been the notion that we are not be it all and know it all, and that we do have to connect to our clients. And one of the things I think as advocators and people who advocate for different things, that we should advocate for training and for more knowledge about the diversity of disabilities, for instance. How do we do that? We advocate for that. We ask our agencies to bring in people that have those expertise for me. That is one of the ways that is key for me. Cece, I think, wants to add something.
Okay. Thank you, Imelda. Cece?
Well, I guess maybe I just kind of want to echo what Nancy was saying, is that I think it is true that in order to attract anybody to our organizations, we have to look like we're interested in working with them, and that our facilities, the people that we have providing services, have to look like the people that we're trying to engage. And so, if we are interested in, working with people with disabilities, yeah, it might be important to have someone who has disabilities there, two or three or four people that have disabilities, but I think it also might be, just in the environment itself, looking like one that welcomes people with disabilities. Down to the magazines that you have on the table, the artwork that you have on the walls. I mean, those type of things. Because I think sometimes, what happens is that organizations might go out and hire one person with disabilities, hire one black woman, hire one Asian woman, and think, oh, okay, we're really doing it. But when you walk into the facility, it doesn't even look like the people that you're trying to serve. And then that is not a welcoming environment, for people. Plus, the last thing that came to mind was having people that we're trying to serve being a part of the decision making and the planning of whatever that organization is trying to achieve.
So important. Thank you, Cece. How about the folks from Life? Is there someone there who wants to give us a final thought for the audience today? Donna, Kate?
This is Kate. I think pretty much Cece and Imelda and Nancy have said it very well about how we can engage, and it really is being willing to engage as well, being willing to change the way our pictures look or our magazines are organized, or do we leave space in the waiting area for a wheelchair, or is it only chairs? All of those things, as long as we are willing and open to be learners, I think we can make it happen. It's when I think agencies think they've got it together that they don't.
That willingness is so essential, and being open to learning and growing, that reflection. Donna, anything you want to add? Okay, thank you, Kate. How about either the folks from Praxis or Manavi? Do any of you have a final thought you'd like to leave us with?
I had a thought. This is Diane from
Praxis. Hi, Diane.
Praxis. Hi. One of the things that I was thinking, and Nancy might have a comment on this, is the importance also of us being allies to the disability rights movement and thinking about ways that we can be supportive of and partners with those efforts.
That's an excellent point. Nancy, do you want to respond to that?
Oh, absolutely. I think for a whole host of reasons, one of which being just the interplay between all different types of oppression and how they sort of come together and support violence against women. And I think that's absolutely true for ableism in terms of people with disabilities, but also autism for deaf individuals. And I think that, you know, the disability community can really benefit from all of the voices of our movement in terms of supporting the various efforts that they're undertaking. And I think that would go a long way in terms of building relationships as well.
Well, that's an excellent point to wrap this call up with. We've had really fascinating conversation. I so appreciate all of our guests in the fishbowl today, as well as the many people who called in or wrote in comments or questions. It's been really a very dynamic and interesting conversation. Again, I'd like to thank all of our participants today, CC and Imelda from Nirvana Now, Donna Bavona, Donna Kenny, Kate Johnson from Life, and Nancy Smith, as well as our Praxis and Manavi staff. It's been a fascinating and very helpful conversation, and really we've touched the tip of the iceberg, and we'll look forward to developing these ideas with all of you and hope that everyone who was on the call will let us know what your future thoughts and ideas are and successes about this work that we've identified today. Thank you, everybody. This call is now over.